Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm happy to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Gregory Foster. He is a professor of national security studies at the Eisenhower School for National Security and Resource Strategy, one of the constituent colleges of the National Defense University. Gregory Foster, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
I'm delighted to have you on. I was very much intrigued by an article I saw recently in the Boston Globe with the headline, Top Pentagon Thinker Bemoans Civilian Subjugation to the Military. That top Pentagon thinker being, of course, yourself. What is the background of the story here?
This was part of a group of speakers who were convened to talk about the topic of resetting defense, if you will, and my part of that was to suggest that there are some bigger, more fundamental questions or issues to be addressed before we reach the point of talking about what is implied by the topic of resetting defense, which seems to suggest diving immediately into the details of budgets and force structure and weaponry. And my starting point was to argue that there are some more fundamental things we need to take into consideration about reconceptualizing and redefining and even reorganizing the military to think about seriously reorienting it before we reach the point of just assuming that the military ought to be what it traditionally has been and start talking about budgets and force structure and weaponry.
Well, I'm interested in particular in this question of civilian subjugation to the military. A lot of people would imagine that the United States has a civilian government, that it has a legislature and an executive, and that civilians are in charge of the military. I take it it's not quite that clear.
Well, in fact, my starting point for discussing this whole thing was with civil-military relations. That is the tacit but binding social contract that unites the three major parties to this relationship to one another. The military itself, the military's civilian overseers, both executive and legislative, and society as a whole. And one of the most, probably the most cherished notion in the democratic society we purport to be, that is at the heart of sound civil-military relations, is the idea of civilian control of the military. And my point on that is that I think we are in a position today where, and have been for some time, in which it's arguable whether civilians are truly in control of the military. I think we are facing instead a situation in what we have is civilian subjugation to the military, in which, for a variety of reasons, not least being the fear politicians have of the military as a powerful interest group and constituency within American society, that the military pretty much gets its way in defining what it is, what it does, where it goes, how it operates, and the like. So that's what I mean by the term civilian subjugation to the military.
So the Congress and the President more often than not do what the military tells them to do rather than the other way around. Is that your case?
That is my position. That, of course, is an arguable proposition, since Congress controls the purse strings and the President is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But yes, I think it's pretty much the case that in matters of force structure and weaponry and doctrine and manning and operational employment, most of these folks, not all of them, tend to pretty much let the military have its way.
I can recall some very public, quote-unquote, debates between top generals and the president over how much to escalate the war in Afghanistan or how much to escalate or continue this war or that war. Is that sort of public pressure from the military part of what you have in mind, or what are...
It is in part, but you will recall also that President Obama very publicly relieved General McChrystal of his duties, and I think...
Right, but not for publicly telling him how much to escalate a war, for making offensive comments about the vice president and so forth.
Well, but that was also complemented by statements he made about the size of the force that was needed in Afghanistan. There was more to it than just the locker room comments of members of his staff that were that related to certain public officials. There, that was kind of the catalyst and the centerpiece that seemed to be the reason. But there were also statements he had made before the International Institute for Strategic Studies about the size of the force that was needed in Afghanistan, and so that's why I said what I did there. That was generally seen, I think, by traditionalists anyway, as being an assertion of civilian control. But the ways in which civilian authorities defer to the military, I think, are arguably more subtle than that, and they relate to the weapons we purchase and what we consider to be the, shall we say, the essence of what the military is and ought to do, and how we structure the military and how it operates. Those are the ways in which I think civilians tend to defer to and in essence, subjugate themselves to military preferences.
Are there particular decisions, including weapons purchases, but also including foreign basing and military actions and wars in recent years and decades, that might not have happened the way they did without the military dominating the decision making in the way you're suggesting?
Well, I think the question is up for grabs, whether we would have gotten involved in the ways we have gotten involved in the places we have gotten involved. But there is an almost total sense among the civilians who are supposed to exert authority over the military that what militaries are properly all about is preparing for and waging war. And that, in fact, is one of my central arguments in this in the statements that prompted you to call me, that in an ideal state of civil-military relations, one of the key defining features is a strategically effective military, not just a militarily effective military. But we tend to conflate those two things. And so I'm calling for a military that is fundamentally different in its essence than the military we now have, which is a warfighting military that arms itself with the highest technology, most destructive weapon systems, and structures itself to wage war, and assumes that a military that can effectively wage war is one that can do other things successfully and effectively, and I think it cannot. And so civilian politicians, both executive and legislative, and society more generally, I think, defer to the military's sense of itself, that what it is and ought to be all about is preparing for and waging war. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think that, in fact, part of my comments focused on the proposition that there is nothing going on now that we could truly characterize as a revolution in military affairs or defense transformation, the two labels or brands or characterizations that are in common parlance. Instead, we're on the cusp of a grand evolution of war that has taken us from a prolonged period dating to antiquity, a period we might characterize as hot war, in which the use of force was central to the conduct of statecraft, to the very compressed period of the Cold War, in which, although we failed on numerous occasions, what was at the heart of statecraft there was the non-use of force against an enemy or enemies that were very much like us rather than unlike us, to the period we are in now, which I think is a period of new war, in which what is called for, but which is heavily resisted, is the use of non-military power and non-traditional uses of the military. This is a period in which we could, if we faced up to it, redefine what militaries properly do. And the logical extension of that, the ultimate end state, what I would call the, as pedantic as it might sound, the normative end state, is a condition of no war, where what is called for is the demilitarization of militaries, as contradictory as that may sound, and the absence of militaries as we traditionally have known them. That is the central provocation that led to my statement about civilian subjugation to the military, because there is hardly anyone who is willing to face up to the proposition that the military should be organized, structured, psychologically prepared, trained, equipped to be something fundamentally different than it is now. Rather, the central driving motive, if you will, of the military and those who purport to oversee the military is that a military is properly in the business of preparing for and waging war. And I don't think you can have achieve an end state of what we might call stable peace with the type of military we now have.
For those of us who see Eisenhower's prediction of the power of the military-industrial complex as very prescient and who see militarism as motivating more wars and making us less safe rather than more safe and want to see diplomacy used rather than militarism, I hear a lot of positive ideas in the idea of demilitarizing the military, but then I don't hear the word diplomacy. I hear non-military power and non-traditional uses of the military. And it's unclear to me, does that mean something smaller and less deadly? Does that mean humanitarian wars rather than non-humanitarian wars? Does that mean drones without pilots instead of planes with pilots? Or does it mean treating the world more amicably and using diplomacy and cooperation in place of aggressiveness? It's not clear. What's the...
I offered in this venue that we're talking about, I offered two very fundamental propositions that play off of an initial statement that our foreign policy, our posture for the conduct of international affairs is very much militarized. Proposition number one is that the military, as an institution, as a culture, as an element of power, as an instrument of power, as an interest group, is not synonymous with, nor does it necessarily equate with, militarization and militarism. That's proposition number one. Proposition number two is that given what militarism is, it's really a fundamental state of mind or an approach to affairs that manifests itself in physical ways. This proposition is that the military, precisely because of the imagery it projects, is the indispensable vehicle for demilitarization. That re-engineering of the military trumps the non-use of the military. For those who would argue that the military's, shall we say, core competency, its essence, is not doing things like peacekeeping and nation building and humanitarian assistance and disaster response, to that, my rejoinder is that only the military can change the imagery of what a military is and ought to be about. So if we are to redefine the essence of the military has to be the central instrumentality for doing that. We can't just decline to use the military, which I think we wouldn't do, because it's there. So what we can do, those in positions of authority seem to think we must do without recognizing its inherent weaknesses and capabilities for what they are. The military itself has to be the instrument for redefining what militaries properly ought to do. And we, the United States, if in fact we are to continue to perpetuate this proposition that we are not only a superpower, but the world's only superpower, then it is not only appropriate for us, but perhaps even incumbent upon us to take the lead in redefining what militaries properly do, what they ought to be all about.
And what so is that? What would they do?
That normative end state that I talked about, a condition of stable peace, if you will. Where we operate now, I offered a continuum that on one axis, the x-axis, takes us from total war to limited war to violent peace to something at the other extreme we might call stable peace. And I juxtaposed against that, on the y-axis, wars of necessity and wars of choice. Where we operate now is the space around limited war and violent peace, and all of the types of situations we face are clearly nothing but wars of choice. Politicians, for rhetorical purposes, like to characterize our involvements as wars of necessity, but they aren't. They are clearly wars of choice. And in that space we occupy now, in which we operate today, that limited war, violent peace area toward the end of the continuum that is what we would call wars of choice, there are two central distinguishing features. Asymmetry, in which we are destined to continue facing those who will employ methods, techniques, approaches that are essentially antithetical to, counter to, our preferred way of waging war. That's characteristic number one, and the other characteristic is unwinnability. The types of situations we face today, especially with the military we have, although politicians will continue to believe that the military offers the most decisive instrument of power available to them, these situations are, by their very nature, unwinnable. So we need to face up to that and get out of the game, because another key feature of the world we live in now, a fundamental aspect of being strategic, is how we manage perceptions and how we exercise power. And whereas during the Cold War, it was all about tacit threat making and the accretion of capabilities, the period in which we live now is all about actually performing and performing successfully in order to galvanize and retain national will. And so when we continue to face situations that are unwinnable, that do not lend themselves to our preferred American way of war, we are destined to fail.
Would a re-envisioned military of this sort receive anything like the level of funding that the U.S. military receives now?
No. I can't tell you what the numbers are. That's why I offered as a caveat, or perhaps a cop-out, in the remarks that I made. That's why I am not at the point where I can credibly talk about budgets and force structure and specific weapon systems, although I could talk about some that with a reoriented military we would, I think, clearly not need. But I don't know what that right budget amount is, but I think clearly a military oriented along the lines I'm suggesting would be markedly less expensive than the one we now have. We would not need the major consumptive weapon systems that we now have, whether we're talking about submarines or tanks or air superiority tactical fighter aircraft. There are lots of dimensions of the military we now have that would need to be fundamentally rethought in order to make the military truly capable of engaging successfully in peacekeeping and nation building and humanitarian assistance and disaster response, and a military that is truly capable of performing successfully in those missions is a fundamentally different military than one that's structured to fight wars.
The United States military and the United Nations have something of a mixed record in terms of disaster relief and humanitarian aid. There was a moment in the escalation in Vietnam when there was massive flooding, and it served as a very convenient excuse to send in troops when the United States was looking for such an excuse. When there's a hurricane in Haiti, the aid workers most desired by the people in Haiti are not soldiers with guns. What makes the military the ideal force for this?
Because again, I would reiterate, if we are to redefine what militaries properly do, the military has to be the instrument for doing that, because it projects imagery that no other institution, no other instrument of power, and I say that guardedly because I recognize the negative connotations associated with the concept of power, only the military can refashion that image. A military that is going to do the sorts of things you're talking about, humanitarian assistance, disaster response, and do so successfully, is one that would have to be prepared, structured, equipped, oriented in different ways than the military we now have, and the military that in turn generates the types of perceptions militaries generate. So all of those concerns we have about ulterior motives and using these other types of contingencies or situations as excuses to militarize, that's at the heart of what I'm arguing against.
How are these views of yours received at among your colleagues? And I mean, the National Defense University is funded by the Department of Defense. Are your opinions welcomed and agreed with?
I made a statement in this gathering that prompted you to contact me that there are two parts of this. Any interaction I might have with shall we say senior policy incumbents within the defense establishment or the larger national security establishment, and I have very little interaction with folks in those positions. I would be willing to offer these propositions. I've been writing along these lines and speaking along these lines for a long time, but I don't have opportunities to regularly interact with people who are making policy choices within the Pentagon. That's one part of the audience. The other part consists of the students and faculty that I interact with. I offer these views regularly, but these are, first of all, let me tell you what my approach is to dealing with students. My approach is to get them to think for themselves. Our students are typically at the rank of lieutenant colonel or colonel, or the Navy equivalent, and federal civil servants of comparable rank, and foreign service officers from the State Department of comparable rank. I never try to impose my views, my preferences on them. I want them to think for themselves. I usually use proposals such as this as provocations to evoke discussion and elicit some reflective observations. But I have to admit, these ideas are so heterodox, so much out of the mainstream, that they don't attract widespread, shall we say, embrace, because they run very counter to the culture with which most of the, or the cultures, subcultures, with which most of these folks are imbued. So these folks do not think of militaries in anything other than very traditional terms.
Many of us hope that that will begin to change, and applaud you for spreading these views. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this week, but we've been speaking with Gregory Foster. He is a professor of National Security Studies at the Eisenhower School for National Security and Resource Strategy, part of the National Defense University. Gregory Foster, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's been my total pleasure. I thank you for having me on.
This past Tuesday's Senate Judiciary Committee's subcommittee hearing on drones was not your usual droning and yammering. Well, mostly it was, but not entirely. Of course, the White House refused to send any witnesses. Of course, most of the witnesses were your usual professorial fare. But there was also a witness with something to say. Fareya al-Muslimi came from Yemen. His village had just been hit by a drone strike last week. He described the effects. All bad for the people of the village, for the people of Yemen, and for the United States and its mission to eliminate all the bad people in the world without turning any of the good people against it. The usual droning and yammering that preceded and followed this testimony seemed more offensive than usual. One witness summarized the general position of pointless witnesses who accept all common wisdom and have no information or insights to contribute. If the drone strikes are part of a war, that's fine, she said. But if they're not part of a war, then they're murder. But since the memos that, quote, legalize the drone strikes are secret, we don't know whether they're perfectly fine or murder. That's the common view of things. But to say it in front of someone who knows something about the killing from the perspective of the victims seems particularly tasteless. The basic facts are barely in dispute. A single individual, President Barack Obama, is choosing to send missiles from drones into particular houses and buildings. Most of the people being killed are innocent and not targeted. Some of those targeted are not even identified. Most of the others are identified as run-of-the-mill resistors to hostile foreign occupations of their or neighboring countries. A handful are alleged to be imminent, meaning eventual theoretical, threats to the United States. Many could easily have been arrested and put on trial, but were instead killed along with whoever was too close to them. If this is not part of a war, apparently, then it's murder. But if it's part of a war, supposedly, it's fine. It's funny that murder is the only crime war erases. Believers in civilized warfare maintain that even in war, you cannot kidnap or rape or torture or steal or lie under oath or cheat on your taxes, but if you want to murder, that'll be just fine. Believers in uncivilized war find this hard to grasp. If you can murder, which is the worst thing possible, then why in the world, they ask, can you not torture a little bit too? What is the substantive difference between being at war and not being at war, such that in one case an action is honorable and in the other it's murder? By definition, there is nothing substantive about it. If a secret memo can legalize drone kills by explaining that they are part of a war, then the difference is not substantive or observable. We cannot see it here in the heart of the empire, and al-Muslimi cannot see it in his drone-struck village in Yemen. The difference is something that can be contained in a secret memo. This is apparently the case no matter whom a drone strike kills and no matter where it kills them. The world is the battlefield, and the enemies are Muslims. Young men in predominantly Muslim countries are posthumously declared enemies once a drone has killed them. They must be enemies, after all. They're dead. I wonder how this sounds to a young Muslim man who's taken to heart the lesson that violence is righteous and that war is everywhere at all times. Do people who blow up bombs at public sporting events think altogether differently from people who blow up peaceful villages in Yemen? Don't tell me we can't know because their memos are secret too. Those who engage in murder believe that murder is justified. The reasons they have, secret or known, are unacceptable. Murder is not made into something else by declaring it to be part of a war. War is rather made criminal by our recognition of it as mass murder. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.